I'm Susan Krieger, obviously, and to my right is my retired guide, Tila, who graces the cover of the book. To my left is my current active guide, Fresco, who appears in the last chapter. I am a sociologist and a writer. I teach in the program in Feminist, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Stanford, and I am unusual for a sociologist in that I draw on my personal experiences in order to develop broader insights. Come Let Me Guide You is my seventh book. I have in previous books also drawn on my personal experiences, but in Come Let Me Guide You, A Life Shared with a Guide Dog, I do so even more intimately and doing this unusual thing of looking at my relationship with Tila over the entire 10-year span of our working life together, looking also at some other relationships in my life that have been enriched and supported by our bond, and finally looking at the introduction of Fresco into our joint life. I should say that although this book is full of interesting stories about my relation with a guide dog and interesting dog stories, it also has some broader themes. And in my mind, first among those is the importance of external support for personal identity. Clearly, my guide dog has helped provide me with that. But beyond that, a second theme that seems very important is that the book calls attention to the nuances of intimate communication, of conversations with self and other, and conversations within the self that help make personal identity possible and that help sustain and create a positive sense of self in particular. The book opens, and I should say the book, I'm going to be talking to you about the particulars of the book, but I think you may see how some of these themes about the importance of external support for personal identity and themes about the nuances of intimate communication. There'll be communication between me and the dog, and as I walk along, I'm also talking to myself as I walk with the dog. The book is full of examples of the nuances of intimate communication between self and other and within the self that help make that daily life work out well. The book opens with a chapter called An Older Guide Dog, which is an unusual way for a book to open, in that usually you start with the beginning, when I first got the guide dog. I was moved to start to write about my relationship with Tila when I had already begun writing a book a great deal about this subject of intimate conversation, intimate communication with self and other. And I was looking for a new chapter, my next chapter. And Tila was approaching retirement. She was 9.5 years old, and we had been together for She was 11 years old. We had been together for 9.5 years at that time. We were waiting for her replacement. And guide dog seemed not to yet have an appropriate dog for me. And so we were waiting. And I had thought that my next chapter would be about that new dog. You know, when I first got Tila, it had opened up a new adventure for me, given me a new lease on life. And I was looking forward to relieving her of her duties and having the next new lease on life. But we waited, and there was no new dog. So I needed to write a new chapter. I was sitting at my computer. I looked down one day, and there was Tila. And I thought, well, why not try her? She's a dog. And you should know, sociologists don't normally write about animal relationships, human-animal relationships. This was a new adventure for me in itself. And as I wrote, I kept showing the chapters to friends, and I would say, is this really interesting? Do you think this is what I should be doing? They end up to be perhaps the most interesting chapters in the book. But it started with, here I was with this older guide dog, and I thought, well, people do normally write about the new adventure, the first time, the younger guide dog. Maybe I'll do a service by writing a bit about the older. So I began to write about what life was like for us at that time. We live in San Francisco. We would be walking down a sidewalk. We'd get to mid-block, and there would be construction. And Tila would put on her brakes and refuse to go by it and turn me around, walk me back to the corner we came from, across the street, make me go to the other side, and then we could keep walking. Or about at that time, while, you know, she was nearing her retirement, we would be walking down the street and we'd approach a bus stop, and she'd take off and try to gallop and run past it because she didn't want to get on a bus. For her, by that time, the buses had become, they were noisy, they have hissing air brakes. When she would get on one and try to sit, it goes up and down hills in San Francisco, jostle her around. She wanted none of that discomfort in her older age. So I found myself running past bus stops. And when we would get home, often if there was construction noise outside or anything unusual, she would go right under the desk or under the table to protect herself. I was very in touch with the change. You know, you get a new guide dog and they'll go to the ends of the earth for you and not show anywhere. But she was showing her cautions with her older age, more difficulty getting in and out of the car. And she was only 11. She's almost 14 now. So she wasn't an old dog. She just was older. Guide dog working age is a limited time span. And I began reflecting on that as I was writing about it. And I put me in mind of how special that period really was, her older age. I felt in a way that it was more special and that I appreciated her more. She seemed more sensitive dog, more complicated dog, because she was kind of talking to me more, telling me what she didn't want to do anymore and what she wanted to do. And I really appreciated her. And I thought, this is really special. This is giving me a great appreciation for older age, seeing it in my guide dog. I also was aware, as I was writing about her older age, that as I walked down the street with Tila and she was guiding me, she was also guiding me. I was also, in my mind, being guided by the younger Tila, the dog I first came home with 9.5 years before. Now, I should mention here, I usually do it at the outset, but since I forgot, I'll introduce it. For those of you who don't know me, you know, why a guide dog has been very valuable to me is I have an eye condition called birdshot retinochoroidopathy that I have had for nearly 20 years now. And this is an autoimmune disease that has caused scarring and inflammation on my retina, resulting in the fact that I have blind areas in my central vision, straight ahead, and in my peripheral vision. In the degree to which I have residual vision, my vision, what I do see is dark or blurry, lacking detail, lack depth perception, lack normal color vision. I may, for example, see something directly in front of me, but I'll miss an object an inch to the side, like a pen on a desk. Or if my eyesight is slightly askew, I may see something a bit to the side, and a full-grown person could be standing directly in front of me, and I just won't see them. So a guide dog is a great advantage because there are many challenges for mobility, given the type of blindness that I have. And I was very fortunate to be given the gift of Tila in 2003. And that's what the second chapter does. After I'd been writing about her older age and realized that I was walking with two dogs, I felt, both the older Tila and my memories of the Tila when young, I thought, okay, I guess there's another chapter here. So I went on and wrote the chapter titled When She Was Young. I found myself really beginning to write a biography of Tila. Tila was born in 2001, and then she was born at Guide Dogs and then was taken by her puppy raisers up to Weaverville, where they raised her. Then I came and met her. So I thought, and I also needed to mention who her parents were. She's half Golden Retriever and half Yellow Lab. And so I inquired into what her parents were like and needed to get her heritage straight there. As I wrote about that early period with her, one of the things I became aware of I needed to explain was how, being half Golden Retriever and half Yellow Lab, I immediately felt I have two personalities within my dog, that her Golden Retriever self was her party girl self, always eager to play and have a good time, and her Labrador Retriever self, to me, was her dutiful self, willing to take commands, the kind of self that makes her a good guide dog, always looking to me for permission. And I felt that her party girl self, especially her playful self, was a good complement to my personality, because I'll walk down the street and feel worried and trying to plan my future and my mind is totally somewhere else. And this dog will say to me, well, maybe there's a party down the block. Maybe something good will happen. Maybe I can do something, you know, constantly call my attention for 10 years to the fact that we need to play. When we're out, we need to have a good time. And that was one of the services that she performed for me, as well as guiding me. I began to write about that. And as I did, I had to confront the fact that I had to speak of this. For 10 years, my guide dog and I have played Frisbee at every opportunity. And one thing that they tell you in the guide dog training that we had, which is that you should never play ball with your dog and never play Frisbee. So this was a bit of a contradiction. I tried to hope that no one was watching us. But it is also true that I used a floppy Frisbee made for dogs, and in the 10 years, we never have come across another person playing Frisbee that has distracted her and caused her to pull me after their Frisbee and to retrieve it. So somehow we've managed in constricted areas and all the rest, but it's been a very important part of our life because there's that Labrador part of her that if I were to be out somewhere, even in a fenced field of some sort, and take off her leash, she would disappear. I wouldn't be able to see her, and she would look for something to eat because anything interesting that you find may be even more interesting if ingested. But with a Frisbee, she could get her exercise. I could throw it, and she will always return to me so that I will throw that Frisbee again. And it became, and it continues to be, a delight of our relationship. So I needed to immediately write about how I got this dog, and I soon began playing Frisbee with her and do it to this day. We did this morning before we came. So that's her playful side and augmenting my personality. We go on in the book to discuss the middle years that I have spent with Tila. One example I would lift from there is this experience. There was a point in her middle period, we're getting on a plane, going on a plane ride, and I'm sitting there, and a man is sitting next to me, and he says, of course, "Oh, nice dog." And then he tells me, "I really wish I could take my pet dog on a plane. I think that when I get home, I'll get him one of those little vests and a doctor's note." And I sit there and nod, ah. And then later, only later, when I got off the plane, did I think to myself, why didn't you say anything? Because I didn't say when I thought maybe I should have said, like, you're thinking, wouldn't it be nice to have a dog on the plane? You're not thinking, wouldn't it be nice to be blind? Wouldn't it be nice to have the source of distress that caused this woman to need the dog? But I didn't say anything like that to the man because over all this time, I have wanted to use my connection with my guide dog to be a positive connection and to create a positive relationship between myself and others. But it does put me in mind the fact that having the guide dog tends to make my blindness invisible, and it makes it invisible and not the central subject of attention or discussion to someone else, but it also can make it invisible to me. And perhaps the most important thing is that I remind myself of the fact that I have this dog not just because it's a dog, but because I'm blind, and I have to pay attention to my blindness and how that is working out each day. But it is an added benefit of the life with a guide dog that it makes the blindness disappear. It's a great distraction. I worry about feeding her. Is she hungry? Is she happy? Where will we play? Am I giving her the right instruction for when we're walking? Rather than thinking, oh, poor me, you know, I have very poor eyesight. I can't see half the things. Instead, it becomes a delight in the dog. And so that invisibility has its advantages and disadvantages. I'm going to pause now because I would like to turn these microphones over to Ann Richardson, who's going to read some excerpts from this early part of the book to give you a sense of, especially of those intimate conversations between myself and the guide dog and of the way in which that has intermingled with my sense of my personal identity during this time. So I think, Ann, I'll invite you up here. Would you be willing to stand on the leashes?
Of course.
Let's see if they'll stay put for you. Okay. I'll get him back down.
This may not be ladylike. I think I got it. Friends have sometimes commented that Tila is like two dogs, the obedient dog who seems calm and still, the guide dog, the Tila when she is working, and the wiggly, active, alert, high-strung dog who simply cannot get enough loving or petting, the Tila when she is off harness with them. She has been those two different dogs over all these years, never letting either one of them slide or change much in their constancy. But for me, she has always been one dog. I know what it takes for her to be obedient, and I value that and take pride in her dutiful working mentality and behaviors. At the same time, her playfulness, her alert party girl, golden retriever self, is a joy to me, and we go back and forth between the two. Had she not that lighter side, her more carefree dog energy, she would not be as good for me, I think, brightening my mood, lifting me up, making each day a new adventure, offering me a new awareness of my surroundings. It's as if she says, you owe it to me. It can't be all work. We have to have some fun. And then we do. Sometimes when I've been playing frisbee with Tila out in a field, when I've decided we are ready to be done because she is tired or we have some place to go and more work to do, I will plan to take the frisbee from her the next time she retrieves it. She can often sense that I'm about to do this, and she holds the frisbee firmly, grasping it resolutely in her mouth, not wanting to let it go. I give a tug, but I cannot get the frisbee out. Give, I say to her. She rolls her eyes up at me, holding tightly to her prize. Give, I say again, yanking it gently because I do not want to tear the frisbee by trying to take it forcibly from her teeth. I get down, squatting in front of her, face to face, nose to nose. Time to go, I say. No, she responds. A while longer. No, I say. Give now. Then I pry open her mouth carefully, but prying nonetheless. She gradually releases the bright red disc. I take it and wave it at her, signaling that I will throw it one more time. I want to reward her for giving it to me and to indicate to her that every time she thinks I'm going to take it does not mean that I will. We enjoy a few more throws, and finally I take the frisbee, hiding my intent, and put it in my bag. Tila then goes off a few paces from me and squats and pees, as I have taught her to do after playing, because the activity stimulates her system. And we are off. As we go, I think about how much her liveliness is a source of pleasure for me. When she plays, I play. When she works, so do I. Often on our way home from doing our errands, my fun-loving dog has stopped at the entrance to a playground 2 blocks from our house. There's a tennis court within it, from which many balls may stray, and a grassy field and side areas where she and I have played over the years. She halts at the entrance to this interesting place in the midst of guiding me, looks longingly and refuses to go on. I cannot tug her forward, cannot command her, I cannot physically make her go. I must instead have a conversation with her. I reach down and pat the top of her head and say to her, yes, I understand you want to go in, but we have to go home now. We'll play another time. I say this thoughtfully as I touch the furrow of her brow, and I must take my time so that she will feel listened to, heard, and understood, her wishes registered. We then proceed up the hill. My dog and I, we talk. We have developed our ways. We have been safe over all these years. Before I got Tila, I was hit by a car I did not see coming while crossing a street. I was tossed up on the hood of the car, spun around, and thrown onto a sidewalk. Fortunately, I was not badly hurt, but it was a warning. You are not traveling safely. After that, I started using a white cane, and soon I wanted to get a dog. It was an extended process of applying to guide dog school, passing an interview and repeated tests, proving I was capable. And then I was given Tila, my golden girl, and I started having adventures with her. Often, especially in the early years, I took her for granted even as she changed my life. I had to get used to being led along sidewalks and to what people would say. Are you training that dog? What a beautiful dog! What's wrong with your eyes? How long have you had her? What is her name? Why can't you tell me? Oh, how nice for you, dear, they would say. I had to get used to getting the dog food and to having fur all over the house. Fur I could not see, but I feared others would see it and think that I kept a dirty house. I had to get used to my black dress pants being covered with golden hair. Guide dog heather, they called it in the school. I had to get used to how to maneuver Tila when Hannah and I were walking together. So many things have happened to Tila and me over the years, so many significant moments. The world has opened up for me and become a more alive place. My blindness recedes as a handicap and becomes a license to travel aided. Walking with Tila, I think about her needs more often than my own, and I think about how to make my experiences into joys, small joys, because I am with her, because that is what she likes to do. It has been a long time that Tila and I have been sharing this road, the sidewalks, the country paths, the city and the desert, the beaches, the campus, the back seats of cars. It has been a long time, and I never want to forget, not one moment of it, not the specialness of having her, nor the select group to which she and I belong. I have been a person who walks with a guide dog. I have had that privilege. I have been able to not walk alone, to share the adventure, to be led by another life. In this case, that life has been more exuberant than perhaps I am, and more attuned to the smells and excitement of the world, more cautious at times. A guide into my future, a guide away from my past and from the noxious stimulants, the harsh noises, the things I might not like about the city. In our comforting of each other, our watching out for each other's safety, in that I have found respite and a home. You got them? I don't want to end up in San Jose.
Thank you. Okay. One thing about a guide dog, they stick close. They don't move, but thank you. And Anne reads so beautifully. I feel she makes my words sound better than when I wrote them. So thank you so much. As you can see, those are some examples from the book. And you can also see I write with this intimate narrative style in relation to the dog, and it's full of many stories with that style. I noticed that when I was writing this book and when I was writing exclusively about our relationship, it freed something in me. I wrote a little more romantically, a little bit more emotionally. It freed that up more, and that was an interesting learning for me, that when the subject changes, that the relation with an animal and writing about that tends to free some of those emotions that are harder to free with other subjects. So these occur throughout the discussion of my relationship with my life with Tila. The book opens out in a middle section to discuss some of our other experiences. I discuss more my increasing blindness in certain of the chapters and how that posed challenges for me, how I was still worried about my safety, about falling, about losing my way, even though I had Tila as a guide. And I discuss some of that in terms of its effects on my sense of self and on our life together. I have a chapter in the middle of the book in which my mother dies during that 10-year period. This happened. Tila and I get on a plane and we fly back to Philadelphia. My sister and her husband meet us at the airport with a sandwich for me and a bowl full of dog food for Tila. And we get in the car and go out and visit my mother during her last days. And Tila with me is, of course, a source of, you know, support, but it's also, it makes me feel more myself in this difficult time. And I discuss that period. I have a chapter in which I discuss my approach to writing, which I call the art of the intimate narrative, in which I talk of how writing about my relationship with a dog figures in with some other writing I've done that also explores issues of personal identity and blindness and difference. I have a chapter called Women and Disabilities, where I discuss a course that I taught at Stanford for the entire 10-year span. Tila was sitting under the seminar table while I was teaching this course. When I began to teach it, 1 year after I got Tila, I was new entirely to the field. I was only recently more seriously blind, and I knew very little. I had to teach myself in order to teach the students, and the story of teaching the course is a story of many of the insights that I have gained that perform a valuable role in the book, in that much of this book is about my own experiences. And this chapter talks about other disabled women's experiences and other disability experiences that helps the reader put my experiences into context. The book concludes with a final chapter called A New Pair of Eyes. I got around in the end to the new boy, because eventually he came to live with us. And this chapter opens with my initial experience with Fresco when I first walked with him, which was, he seemed much a continuity with Tila. He had a fast pace, a smooth gliding motion to his gait. He was an excellent guide. When he moved me around obstacles, it was just weaving. It was very, very joyous to be guided by him. And when I looked down, there was a large golden glow by my side, which was how it was with her. So I said, okay, this is the dog for me. Then we started our training. And I had the in-home training at that time. The trainer came to my home in San Francisco, and we did our training on the streets of San Francisco and down on the Stanford campus. And I started both working with Fresco and appreciating his personality, because a big deal with Tila at the beginning was coming to know her and what she's like, what the dog personality is like, because you really share that. You walk with that. More so even, you're just sharing your life with another personality, even if it happens to be a dog. So I started to get to know his personality. One thing that happened in that very early period during those initial weeks was I picked up the Frisbee. And I said, okay, I'll throw you the Frisbee now. And it made no sense to him. He looked at me, he looked at the Frisbee, he looked at me. I could throw it, and I could still get his attention on it and toss it, and he'll look at me, and he'll look at it, and he'll get real attentive, and I toss it, and he'll sail off after the air, and he'll run right by the Frisbee and put his nose down and smell the ground. He has no retriever instinct, and it's just not anything to him. But he will help me out a little bit by trying to follow my cues, just like he does when he guides, and run after it in a way. But this was very different. And it was, at that initial period, it was a blow to me. I think I felt I lost something, which, you know, for 10 years, that was my central playfulness with Tila. And I really felt probably that I was losing her. And I felt, how could I be okay? How could I ever again be happy if my dog doesn't retrieve a Frisbee? Now, that is very odd, since you have a guide dog for the blind because you can't see. And you need to be guided safely around. And here's this woman worrying about whether the dog will retrieve a Frisbee. The trainer actually took it quite seriously. And he attempted during our weeks of training to see if we could train him to do it. And so we tried. And we put pieces of food on the Frisbee. And he would pick the piece of food up and bring that and eat it and come back for petting. And I took him later on. I took him to the beach. I took him with Tila. And I'd throw the Frisbee to her. And I'd say, watch, see how happy she is. Maybe he learned by example. But yes, they can teach them anything, these guide dogs, to guide you, do all this. They can't. But the trainer said, I think it's not in his nature. And it isn't. What I found out from him, and I had to learn his personality, is that he has a big nose. He has many strong olfactory sensors in his nose. His delight is in smelling. That's why when he runs after the Frisbee or the air that the Frisbee just left, he then puts his nose down on the ground and smells. That's the thing he loves to do. A person will walk by him on the street, and they'll be at a distance, and I'll notice his nose is in the air, and he's following their scent. It's just his joy, and I had to come to realize that following his nose gave him as much satisfaction and joy as, for her, following an object thrown on the fly. But it was an adjustment, and it said something about how hard it was for me to replace my first love of a guide dog with my second love of a guide dog. And that chapter is a lot about that process, which eventually was successful. But I was in tears for days in the initial period. You know, I was going out every morning without her. And that would be a sign of the importance of the relationship and how similar it is to have a relationship this intimate, every step, every breath for 10 years with a guide dog. You know, it's like any other intimate relationship in your life. That's what I would think about as I'm writing about it. It's not just in a relationship with a dog. So the other thing that happened during this period that was an adjustment was, so not only did he not retrieve, when he first came to our house, he was very withdrawn. Now, I don't know that he was exposed to a city before when he wasn't working, and he's an excellent guide. I mean, he races to the corner, stops just on the dot, leads me around things, is very cautious. He couldn't be better. So not retrieving, you know, was a bit of a side. But in addition, when he first came, he was withdrawn. We live in the city. I think maybe that was new to him. He was moving into a house with two other dogs, three cats, two strange people. And he just sat and curled into a ball and watched us for a long time. And I thought, I'm used to this lively dog that's always up. And so I thought, we got to try to pep him up, make him happy to greet people. And no sooner was I thinking about this than I think Tila was thinking about it too. And the chapter describes how she started to see that this dog was withdrawn, and she started to get over him and stand next to him and paw at him and try to make him play with her. She would get down on the ground, you know, put her elbows down and her rump in the air, reach up her paw and try to get him to come down and play with her the way she wanted to play. And we watched her do this day after day, several times a day, to get him to play. And it was a great joy to me that after a month, the first thing they did every morning is play. Many times a day they played. She had succeeded bit by bit with him, and they have become, and they became very, very important to each other. But she really knew somehow what was needed, and as if she wanted to tell him, you know, you play with her. This is what a guide dog does. You stop at the curbs, but really you gotta put some life into it. And so now he's a normal, lively dog. I think there was something at the beginning, but the chapter is about these challenges when you move from one significant relationship, one important intimacy, the next, and what can happen to make that more possible over time. So he likes to watch little children. If I take him to a little league game or a game where they're 8 years old or something running around in the field, I've noticed he watches them raptly. He's very happy. So I find myself going to places where there are little children and sitting and we watch them. But you want to enjoy what your dog enjoys, odd as it may sound. It provides a sense, at least for me, of personal fulfillment. So we will now take a bit of an excerpt from that very last chapter to give you a sense of the kind of changing of the guide dog.
At night now, as I reach down next to our bed and touch Fresco, I finger his nylon collar, which helps me distinguish him from Tila. Good night, good guide. Thank you, I say to him. And the words seem strange and new, as if I should not be saying these to any other dog than Tila. Tila comes into the bedroom later. I hear the tinkling of her collar as she enters and gets down onto her bed beside Fresco's, a small space dividing them. She lies down. I reach over to touch her, pat her soft fur. Thank you, good guide, girl. My tears are slow and gentle. For the moment, I have the company of these two. I will treasure this moment as long as I have it, and as long as their two tongues lick me in the morning, their noses wet, fresh from their night's sleep, letting me know they are ready for me, their person, their woman in need of a guide dog, to get up and take them out. On Tila's neck, on her silver collar, I have left the tag that says guide dog, rather than substituting one that says retired guide that guide dog sent me over a year ago. I want Tila never to be retired, but to continue to lead the way for me, even as I follow Fresco. I look to her to help me with him, to help me know what might be possible, that the bond can grow, the depth of feeling be sustained, the learning be unexpected and enjoyed. As I walk with my new guide, I see less than I did when I walked with Tila, for my eyesight has diminished over time, although my life has not diminished but grown. As Fresco pulls me forward, guiding me in his way, prompt turns, a gliding motion to his step, showing me the importance of exploring while sniffing, as I follow this dog who curls into a ball when at home, his body so characteristically his own, as I learn to love him as I did Tila, I hope to be as deserving of his love, his loyalty, hers as well, as they take me not only along streets, but into a world of their pleasures. At Fresco's graduation ceremony, held on the guide dog's campus at the end of our training period, that afternoon out in the sun, the puppy raisers handed their dogs over to their new persons on a broad stage before family and friends. Hannah sat in the audience looking up proudly at Fresco and me. When it came our turn, I was led across the stage to stand beside the mother of the family who had raised Fresco, with whom he had been sitting. She took his leash and handed him to me, tearfully wishing us well. She and her husband each gave me a warm hug. She then read a statement by their high school-age daughter, who was unable to attend. I once wondered what it would be like to be blind. Although as a little girl, I tested this wonderment through the basic blindfold, I never truly experienced what it was like. Some may say that the God-given gift of sight is man's most important sense, but I, with my sight, beg to differ. It has been a definitive fact in every science textbook that there are five senses: taste, smell, sight, touch, and the ability to hear. Through the processes of raising guide dogs, I have discovered a sixth: love. The trust that a blind person has for their dog is remarkable. Not only do they trust this dog to not poop in the house, but also to be their eyes. These dogs cross streets, hop onto buses, and go everywhere else in between. I have a strong belief that love surpasses sight in every aspect, and that a guide dog is the epitome of love. Fresco, as you continue on your journey as a guide dog, I wish you the best of everything, the best belly rubs, walks, food, and potty breaks. Good job, Bubba. As I walk now with Fresco, the memories of Tila echoing in my mind, I cherish the spirit of those who raised him, the love that went into him, the journey we are on, a longer one than I ever expected. Tila is at home when I am out with Fresco, yet at other times I walk with her, using my white cane and a leash, or letting her roam free as we go. I play with her, throw her balls and frisbees to retrieve, our old habits sustaining us, the new ones evolving. And when I'm following Fresco, I often hear Tila in my mind talking to us. I said I would help you. Here we go again. I said I would help you. Now, Fresco, remember. Remember to watch out for cars and curbs and holes in the ground where she might trip. Remember that she does not easily trust. Play with her. Retrieve a little. Make it a good life for her. I am turning her over to you now. Keep your paws clean and your heart pure. Fresco, come walk beside me. Come, take her from me. And Fresco lifts his head and turns toward me. Come, he says. Come, let me guide you.